You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
You're listening to episode number 48 of Living the Dream with Rory O'Malley. You know what? If you like the podcast, you should subscribe to it, rate it, and review it. Come on.
Audition, side job, swimming upstream. Believe it or not, you're living the dream.
Hello, dreamers. Welcome to Living the Dream. I'm Rory O'Malley, your host. My guest this week is the hysterical, amazing, such a great guy, Taron Killam. Taron is best known for his years of work, his brilliant, funny work on Saturday Night Live, an American institution. He is awesome, such a good guy, has a wonderful wife and family, the perfect kind of person to have on this podcast because he has stayed so positive and worked for a really long time, his whole life, since he was a young man. He is also in the club that I belong to, King George the Third Club. He is King George the Third, the Fifth. He took over on Broadway for me when I left the show to go do the tour. He was the king who stepped into my shoes, or rather put on my crown. I always joke that I can't believe they found the one human being who would be more ecstatic and excited to be taking over for the king than I was, but they did. Taron was so thrilled to be on Broadway, and it made my leaving that much easier because I was handing over the crown to somebody who was so thrilled and honored to be a part of the show, and we had this amazing coronation, as we call it, that was started by Brian D'Arcy James, the handing over of the crown and the garter, and inducting the next king into the royal order of the garter. And we had that ceremony where I inducted him. Taron, of course, being a comedy veteran, came to the induction ceremony prepared. He was wearing tearaway pants and wearing leopard print underwear under them. So when it was time to put the garter on his leg, he tore those pants off and surprised us all. At that moment, I knew we had chosen the right king, the rightful successor. Taron's just such a great guy. We've had a lot of crossover, and we've never really gotten to work together other than that, but I'm sure we will at some point. He also has a movie that is available on iTunes called Killing Gunther, starring him and a wonderful ensemble of actors, including Arnold Schwarzenegger. So you should definitely check that out. It's hysterical. He wrote it, directed it, and stars in it. So I got to talk with him about that experience and the experience of Saturday Night Live, which, you know, I'm a huge fan of the show, and I am a huge fan of his work on that show. He really got into a lot of the details of his career and also how he balanced his family life with his famous wife. Kobe was on the very successful sitcom How I Met Your Mother for many, many years. She's been in The Avengers. They both have such successful careers and have to figure out how to raise kids at the same time. So his insight on that is pretty great. Please enjoy my conversation with Taron Killam. Hi, Taron.
Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having
me.
This is the first time we've had another king on the podcast.
Whoa, that's huge.
This is huge.
That feels huge.
We have so much to talk about those 10 minutes.
Heck yeah. And then how to milk it. What to do in between the
literally
10 minutes.
Literally, every note I get basically is just like, can you speed it up a little bit?
Really?
I'm like, come on now. I got 9.5 minutes.
You're still getting notes?
Oh, hell yes.
Because you are like, you're the king. I mean...
So whatever I
don't know that anybody has done the run by half as long as you, correct?
Well, I don't know. I definitely have done it. Oh, yeah. Because yeah. I've been, and I'm going to do it until like Social Security kicks right. in. But no, I mean, I definitely have done it longer than him, but I don't know, double. I think they did like, he did Broadway for like 8 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I did like 10 months after that, and now I've done...
But he took time off.
Yeah. He didn't miss a show, but he missed, like...
He had to work. He had other commitments.
He had many movies. I finally watched his...
Mindhunter. I'm 2.5 in. Yeah, it's amazing.
It's amazing. Yeah. Yeah, and it's my favorite show of all time, because it's the only reason I was in Hamilton.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. So we're here in L.A. You're from mm-hmm. Los Angeles. You're from California. You grew up in Big Bear.
Correct. Yeah. From like second grade to eighth or ninth grade. Yeah.
Second grade, ninth grade in Big Bear. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that is, for people who don't know what Big Bear is, that's like a small skiing.
Yeah. Resort town.
Resort town.
3 hours east of Los Angeles.
Yeah. How do you get involved in being an actor or a comedian? In
showbiz.
There. Yeah.
It had kind of started before.
Okay. Before second grade.
Yeah. Wow. My first like audition was when I was 5. It was like doing commercials and stuff.
Wow.
For the Cunningham Agency. Yeah.
You were born here in the city.
Born in Culver City, where we are right now. Yeah.
Wow.
And my parents lived in Manhattan Beach and uh-huh. were like artisan hippie types. And my family was sort of showbiz adjacent. My mom's uncle was Robert Stack, which was like the big deal. And then a few other cousins and uncles and people trying to crack it in showbiz. My mom, a musician, my dad, at one point aspiring actor, that turned aspiring musician, turned contractor for most of my life, now turned actor again. Wow. So it was always a family thing.
Yeah.
And we went to this Manhattan Beach Community Church where they would put on productions there. So I was already doing like Wizard of Oz and The Nutcracker and stuff like that from a little age.
Wow.
And then my mom took me and my younger siblings out and to like to meet an agent. And I was just precocious enough to walk into a room of strange adults and not clam up.
Right.
Yeah.
So you get to Big Bear and you were able to keep that going, or like did you have...
There's like big breaks, right? Yeah, like I would say, yeah, 5 to 6.5, 7 was doing it down here, then stopped, then got involved in theater in Big Bear. At the Performing Arts Center and this theater group that's still up there called CATS. I don't know what it stands for, but it is an acronym for something. It's the Center Arts Theater.
They just do the musical CATS.
It's just CATS over and over.
Oh, every
longest
season.
Running production of CATS.
So they just like, let's just call ourselves CATS.
In a Big Bear 99 seat theater. Full ensemble, full cast, 99 seat theater.
The entire town. Cramped. They need the entire town to be
every
in it
night.
Or they can't.
Every night.
Wow. That's brilliant.
Yeah, no, and we did it up there. And then I remember there was like this really low budget, like kids camp movie that shot up there. And all the local kids who at all were interested in performing or whatever were extras in it.
Right.
And that was very exciting. And that, I think, I don't remember how it worked. But then because of that, there was a local agent up there. And then she partnered with somebody down here and they were willing to represent me.
Right.
And then once every 2 or 3 months, we'd come down for like 2 days and I'd go on a bunch of auditions and occasionally get like something small. And then middle school happened and I was like, nah, I just want to do school. And then kept doing school plays and stuff like that locally. When I was 14, I guess, I auditioned for LOXA, the LA County High School for the Arts. And I got into that.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So I went to performing arts with Groban.
Right. You went to high school with Josh Groban and I went to college with him.
I know. We do. We have a big crossover in our Venn diagram.
It's true. So you went to school there, and mm-hmm. that's when you started doing like the Disney stuff, or
towards the end, right? Okay. Yeah, like I would say end of my junior year, into my senior year, started trying to go back out again, and at the like last week of high school, booked this Nickelodeon gig, and that I got to work for like 2 weeks on that, which was really fun,
right?
And then went to UCLA for musical theater and stopped because my agency disbanded. They were like, we're out of business.
Wow.
And I was like, that's great. I want to go to UCLA. I want to focus on that. And then that Nickelodeon show, the Amanda show, called like 5 months later and said, we want to do another round of your episode, your sketch that we do. And I said, okay, but I don't have any reps. So Dan Schneider, who created that show, he's like, I'll help you get hooked up. And he did. Wow. And then from then on, it was pretty nonstop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So did you, but did you go to Groundlings after that or?
I did. So
really the Amanda Bynes show was like, this is sketch and.
Right.
Then Groundlings came along.
Exactly. It was the Amanda show. It was a parody of Dawson's Creek called Moody's Point.
Okay.
And I was like a sort of whiny, hard on his sleeve, pacey thing to the nth degree. Sure. And then that was in January. Then towards the end of my freshman year, I auditioned for Mad TV. I got that kind of on a fluke.
Right.
Did that for like most of a season. I did like 13 episodes and then was asked back, but for less episodes than promised. And anyway, it was dumb, boring showbiz stuff. But all my reps were like, forget it, move on, go to other things. So I took that advice, but then I also loved doing sketch off of that show and loved the people that I worked with who mostly had come from the Groundlings. So after Mad TV, then I went back and started doing Groundlings.
Wow.
Like 7 years there.
That's amazing. So we've had Edie Patterson on the show. So, you know, we talked about
in-depth the process.
Yeah. But for you, you have to go to that first Groundlings class,
yeah,
which is basically like zip zap bop,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Like just
fourth
basic,
wall,
yeah,
choose an accent,
very
yeah.
basic yes. improv games. But I mean, if you had 1 year of school, and so you were probably excited to go into a learning environment.
Truly,
however, you're in Groundlings with people who maybe have never been on a stage before.
Definitely.
In that first class.
Definitely, yeah. Yeah.
So you go in there and they're like, oh, I was on Mad TV for 13 episodes.
Yeah.
Was that weird?
I certainly did not like make that known. And I went into the class with two friends, with Nassim Pedrad.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
She and I were living together with two other guys at the time.
Wow.
And our buddy Kyle Kennedy, who's now a main company member, Groundling member.
Yeah.
So we all did our basic class together because Mikey Day, who is also living with us and is now on SNL, had already kind of gone through the process. He was like waiting for the final level.
Yeah.
And we're like, we should do it. That'd be so fun. And I was like, yeah, everybody Groundlings. So level one was great.
Yeah.
Because a little bit like taking it on a lark, like, let's see what this is. Cause I'd never done stand-up. I'd never done improv. I'd never done training for comedy. I'd only done training for, you know, the arts, for performing
acting.
Arts. And it was so fun. And it was. And yes, it was very uneven. And there were some full-fledged kooks in there. But that's sort of what's really fun about it too.
Yeah.
And like Eliza Coop was in that class with us. It was a stacked class. It was so fun.
Wow.
And like made really good friends. And at that level, to me, the pressure was fully off. It wasn't until like later in the process when you'd invested time and it was like pass fail and people are judging you. Did it feel more precious or intense?
But how old were you when you took that first class after Mad TV?
Like probably 20.
I mean, at 20, after you could, there's a lot of people, performers, who would go be on a TV show and be like, well, I don't have to learn anymore.
Yeah. You're
you know, sure. like, I don't have to go, I don't want to go back.
Right.
I should just be going forward. And I'm already 20 years old. Like, it's too late.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And so, like, thank God you found some friends who we're like, let's just do this for fun and see what happens. I mean, especially because so many of those people in, you know, on SNL, Mad TV, it's all from those insular groups of
truly
young comedians
sketch,
coming up together.
Sketch improv troops or stand up or now sort of like online sketch writing is sort of a grooming ground, like The Onion or Funny or Die
or
College Humor.
Josh Gad and I actually took two classes at the Groundlings.
No way.
Together.
Wow.
And we both got jobs. So I wanted to do it desperately.
Yeah.
I was scheduling it around my restaurant work at the Grove.
Okay.
But I got a
Wood Grill?
The Wood Ranch.
Wood Ranch.
Yes.
Wood Ranch.
The Wood Ranch.
Sorry.
And
awesome.
Marmalade Cafe.
Oh, the two bigs.
Yes.
You did
bigs.
The circuit.
Still there.
I
did the circuit, got fired from both. I was a terrible waiter, but it really was because I was like constantly leaving to do shows for $7 a show,
in
theaters. So I got one of those and didn't go back to the Groundlings. And I'm always bummed because it would have been so cool to have finished that.
Yeah.
Even if we didn't go all the way through, Gad and I, it would have been so much fun to be in that group a little bit more because you guys are a team, not like throughout everything. I feel like there's such a supportive environment,
totally.
Even if it's competitive.
Yeah, I think without a doubt, I think anything, you know, it's Malcolm Gladwell kind of 10,000 hours, and it does take a long time to get to the main company. So that by the time you're there, whether or not your sensibilities overlap, you certainly have respect for everybody who's a member with you.
Yeah,
and people have dedicated and sacrificed so much to be there.
Yeah.
That it's very rare you get anybody who takes it for granted.
Right. And you see what so many of the other people have gone on to do after they leave there.
Totally.
So
you very feel, impressive. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So were in your early days there, were you like SNL is an end goal for you?
I think after Mad TV and the fact that that happened and that I still, like, I left the show with no experience, but knowing that I had started to do a good job on the show too.
Sure.
Like, I was like, oh, I could do this. So I do think that SNL kind of quickly became the focus in that. Yeah. I knew if I ever got the opportunity to be seen or to audition, that I would have a good shot.
Right. And especially now that you had the, I'm sure it's hard for people who go from Groundlings in front of a live audience without cameras onto SNL.
Yeah.
That's a big transition, but you did it the opposite way. You were used to the camera.
Yeah.
So it was on your radar primarily.
Yes. And the process at Groundlings was long. I did the first two levels very quickly, and then I waited a year and a half maybe for the third one. So I like worked in between. And then I did the third one, and then I worked between the third one and the fourth one.
Right.
And the between levels three and four was like almost 2 years, maybe a little over even. So there's a lot of downtime at Groundlings too.
Yeah.
And then doing Sunday Company was like one of the most important creative development, educational bonding times of my whole life and will forever be.
I mean, we talked about it a little bit with Edie, but it's just constantly putting up a show with
every week
people at the top of their game.
Exactly right.
So it's basically the best training ground for SNL there is.
I really think in terms of like a direct parallel to the process, I really think so.
So what was your audition experience, or how did SNL come along?
Lauren came to a show, and we're pretty sure to kind of scout Nassim, because Nassim had sent in a tape and it had gotten to Tina Fey, and so like she was on the radar. And Lauren came to the show and flew four of us out.
Wow.
And that was so fun. One of the most fun, thrilling experiences ever, just because you get to be in the space for the first time and you get to be on the stage for the first time, and they're flying you to New York. And we like rented a limo. Our group rented a limo to pick us up and like drive us into Manhattan. And
just
I put together
to
like
officially
a CD of like New York songs. So it was like Frank Sinatra and Jay-Z, Alicia Keys, you know, like all the New York centric songs.
Had you spent a lot of time in New York before that?
No. I had been there maybe, you know, five or six times. My mom worked for the airlines when I was in high school. So like the first time I ever went to New York, I was 16, and my dad and I flew standby to see Death of a Salesman with Brian Dennehy.
Wow.
Yeah. And that was a really cool, whirlwind, exhausting experience.
Yeah.
Then I didn't go there to look for schools. I auditioned for Juilliard, but in San Francisco. I flew up to San Francisco to do that and didn't get in. Didn't even make it to the second round.
Me neither.
Did you have to act like an animal?
I don't remember. It was some kind of like warm-up thing.
Yeah.
I think I remember that. It was like a group session.
Yeah.
I had to act like an animal once I got into school. Paying for
it.
A whole semester of acting like a gorilla.
Yeah.
But
I did it in high school. So I was like, not this again.
Oh, man.
They like
this is what they do at Juilliard, too. This is what they're talking about, the good stuff.
Yeah.
So you're in New York. You're in a limo.
It was a party, and it's like all that your A material that you've been working on now at this point for 7 years. And you leave it on the stage. You feel great. It was so fun. I did it with Nassim. I did it with my buddy Greg and then Jillian Bell, who wrote on SNL for a season and now is, you know, in Girls Trip. Not Girls Trip. Rough Night.
Oh, yes. With
Scarlett Johansson.
Yes.
And she was one of my favorite people to write with in Sunday Company. So it was just so exciting. We go home. 2 weeks later, they're like, we're going to fly out again and we want to see all new stuff. So I go like 2 weeks later and I'm like, now it feels real.
Right.
It feels possible. And it's going to be everything that I cut out of the first audition. Right.
Right.
And maybe, and like tried to, all right, well, what did I not do last time? What's a different move I could show?
Right.
Way overthought it, was way in my head, was way stressed out.
How can you not overthink it and be stressed out?
Thank you. I'll take that.
It's that moment.
Yeah.
So it's like, that's what it's going to be, is stress and overthinking.
It was a lot of that, and it still went fine. And then we were kind of unofficially told, it's not now, but it's not never. Like, right. He's on our radar. And so that was nice to hear. And I took it with a grain of salt, because I would have driven myself crazy if I was like, they'll remember me.
Yeah.
They'll call.
Yeah.
But I did. I took the rest of the year to finish Sunday Company, get into the main company, and have in the back of my head, I should be thinking about stuff I would maybe do or audition with if I do get asked back.
Right.
And I did. A year later, they called kind of out of the blue. They hadn't even seen me or anything, but they just said, come on back.
Wow.
And that one went very well. That was sort of like game day. All right, let's be professional, but let's not psych ourselves out. And let's also not be sentimental or whimsical about it, which I maybe was in the first audition.
You rented a limo.
I rented a limo.
So yeah.
And I definitely
went out.
I was like, let's go to dinner. And everybody else was like, I'm going to go in my room and just rehearse. And I was like, oh, I should probably do that too.
Yeah.
And then the third time was a charm. Yeah. So I did the third audition a year later. Again, 2 weeks after that, they say, come fly out just to meet Lorne. I do that. It's not particularly exciting. It's sitting around and it's just kind of showing you're not a crazy person.
Right.
And then met with Lorne. He didn't say one way or the other in the room, but he did say, all right, this will be over soon. And I said, oh, thanks. And hated that I said, oh, thanks. Cause did that sound like it'll be over soon?
Yeah. I got to get out of here. I got better things to do.
Yeah. So it was in my head about that. I went to, did you ever go to, Max Brenner Chocolate by the Bald Man on 13th University or something like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I went and had dinner there.
Okay.
Fed my feelings.
Mm-hmm.
Went across the street to the movie theater.
Mm-hmm.
Saw The Expendables.
Ah.
The first Expendables film.
Wow.
Yeah, that's...
Man.
Dating myself, The Expendables. We're three deep now.
Yeah.
Maybe four.
Yeah, I can't believe... I'm like, I didn't realize that's how long ago the first one came out.
Yeah, 2010.
They've been pumping them out.
Dang, man.
Man.
It's a machine. That's the dream. That's living the dream.
That is living the dream.
Get on the roster of The Expendables.
We'll put together an Expendables with just former KG3s.
Just Broadway for The Extendables.
Yeah.
Just like...
This time with jazz hands.
I mean,
maybe. So we're going to make it happen.
And then I walked all the way from 13th University back up to Midtown just to be like, I just got to.
You needed to get out that energy.
Exactly.
Tire yourself out.
Get back to my hotel room at like 1:15 in the morning, something like that. And Seth Meyers calls me and tells me, hey, I just want to say on behalf of Lorne Michaels, we want to hire you on the show. And I just like lost my mind.
He called you after 1:15 in the morning.
Yeah, because they knew I had to get an early flight back. I was like, give me the earliest flight back because I want to get... We had a child at that time.
And yeah.
I want to get home. And so he said, we know you have to fly out at like 5 a.m. or whatever. So we just thought we'd give you some good news. I was like, thank you. But they admit I had to leave at 5 a.m. to get to like a 7 a.m. flight. And I get on the plane. And as I'm walking to my seat, Seth Meyers is sitting in business class. He's like, Taryn, you're a goddamn liar. And I was like, what? I had to leave. I don't know where you got the info. I'm grateful. Don't fire me.
Oh my God. You were seriously shitting though, because you were less like, you get it. And then you think you were caught in something did you still have that nervous energy that you would in the room with Lauren?
It was all nervous. And so like not directed in anything, like not what's the funny thing to say? What's the cool thing to say?
Yeah.
Like is everything is insane right now.
Yeah. But did you even sleep that night?
Very little. Cause talked to Seth, called my wife. Got a message, called my mom, she was up. And it's like 11, you know, even though it's 1 or it's like 10, it's late for her.
And she knew this was going on?
Yeah, and she's like, you know, you could hear, she's like, hello. Siri's joining now.
Who's telling me?
What the heck happened? Did I say something that sounded like Siri? Oh my God, is what it said.
She said, you're telling me.
You're telling me. Oh wait, you just told me. Oh, don't, Siri, don't be funny, okay?
Please.
Go to Groundlings. Yeah. And so I called my mom and she was like, you know, hey mom. Hello. So I did it. Went good. Uh-huh. And I got it. Of course you did. And fully broke down. And I was thanks mom. And then Kobe was calling on the other line. So I was like, mom, I gotta go. Yeah. Talk to everybody, called all, the closest people in my life. And it was crazy. And then, maybe slept 3 hours, maybe.
Right.
But seeing, it was so weird. So weird that Seth's the one who called. Seth was on the plane and it was American and he was flying business. And he's like, yeah, if you work hard for 11 years, someday you'll be in business class.
Right.
One section up. Yeah, and it was it was the most exciting moment of my life professionally.
Right.
Certainly, the most, Charlie finding a golden ticket moment.
It's not like there are that many moments in a career where it's so clearly this huge win.
Yes.
Because sometimes you get a job, you don't know what it's going to turn out to be.
Exactly,
You know what SNL is. You know what it means to be given the honor of getting that job.
It's the first and maybe only, and then Hamilton was the next one.
Yeah.
Job where my parents-in-laws could tell their friends and their friends would be impressed no matter what they did.
Right.
Right.
They didn't have to explain what it was.
It was that. So it was a big deal. And certainly by far just the most euphoric moment.
Right.
Yeah.
So you were living in LA. You'd only been in New York a handful of times.
Mm-hmm.
What did that mean personally? You have a kid
Kobe
a successful wife.
Yeah, so she was still on How I Met Your Mother.
Right.
We had a one-year-old, one and change child at that point. So they give you a relocation fee. You have to find an apartment. You don't know how long you'll last. Yeah. I certainly did not have any confidence of we got to move our life out there.
Right.
So got a place at 54th and 7th, right in the thick of it. Right. Easy for work. When people come to visit, this is the theater district. We're in it. And then would travel back and forth. I commuted 4 seasons back and forth every hiatus week. I'd fly back to LA. Yeah. It was a lot. It was tiring.
Yeah. It's exhausting. And so your schedule, you would have weeks off at a time or? Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's SNL's a weird one because it's dependent upon the broadcast schedule and the holiday schedule and football schedule and host availability. So they usually start the season a little top heavy. There were a couple of years where we'd do 4 in a row, which was a lot.
Yeah.
And then it'll be 3 or 4 and then a week off and then 2 or 3 and then 2 weeks off. And then, and it just jumps back and forth like that the whole season.
So tell me about walking into your first day at SNL. What is a first day at SNL? Is it just with everyone else? Is it filling out paperwork in HR?
Ours was pretty gentle, I think. I think it can be extreme.
Yeah.
I just worked with Rob Riggle, who he's I was the only guy hired that year.
Wow.
And they're be here tomorrow kind of thing. And so it was just trial by fire.
Yeah.
With us, there were 4 of us. So they had come for an orientation meeting at the producer's office and meet everybody. And we'll walk around. We'll tell you what to do and what not to do to a point.
Who were the other 3 with you that year?
It was Vanessa Bayer, Jay Farrow, and Paul Britton.
Right.
Yeah. And still incredibly close and get along with all 3 of those people and love them endlessly.
Yeah.
It was nice and easy. And Forte had left the year before. He was the only one who departed. So it was a bigger cast.
Right.
But it was fun. And mine was a slow burn. I got my first sketch in my 4th episode.
That's pretty good.
That felt good. That felt right.
That's amazing.
That felt good. And then had a pretty productive first season, after that. And then once we got the pickup for the second season, I could kind of tell that I would probably be there for a while.
Right.
So Kobe and I, looked to buy a place and we ended up buying in Battery Park City and set up this apartment knowing that once her show was done, the family would move out there full time.
Wow.
So we did that 3 years ago and we just got back in August.
Wow.
We're in New York full time. Yeah.
And how, yeah. So you have that schedule, you're living in New York and she's always constantly working, obviously.
Yeah.
How do you guys, keep the balance between your careers, your marriage and your kids? Like that's a lot, especially when you're dealing with two very successful careers on opposite coasts. Obviously it ended 3 years ago for her, that big show, but
yeah, we've been lucky for the most part. Her schedule on How I Met Your Mother at that point was very, flexible, very supportive, you know, cause we had a child and the season before she'd been pregnant and, due back or whatever.
Yeah.
So we've just been very lucky. But I think more than anything, it just has the most to do with the people that we are and our priorities, which is always each other and our family before anything else.
Yeah.
All that, you know, there's a lot of work that both she and I have turned down and said no to because logistically it just is not conducive to what we want out of life, you know, and because we're spoiled in that we have that flexibility. We have that privilege to go like, we don't necessarily need this job at this time.
Right. This movie shooting in another country and uprooting our entire family might be great for a resume, but it's not great for our kids. So we're not going to do it.
Correct. Yeah.
It sounds obvious, but I think that as an actor, it's hard to turn anything down because we're always living in that fear of this is it. Nothing will ever come along.
100%. And we're still retraining ourselves because both Kobe and I are people who also want people to like us and want people to know we're nice. And so have a really hard time saying no to people. And that's been its own skill to develop. Cause like you said, me longer than her, spent so much time going like, please, anybody, I'll do anything.
Yeah.
And now to be very fortunate to have some control, some flexibility is takes an adjustment. We're still adjusting to it.
To not have that feel of desperation that you have to jump
keep
at
it
any
going
possibility
and keep
that
the momentum and people will forget and people will not think of me or want me or care or, you know, all that stuff. So I do know it is part of our makeup anyway. Even if we didn't have all the success, there'd be more sacrifice and there'd be probably, you know, longer, more intense discussions. But you know, I think it would be that way anyway.
Yeah.
For she and I, that's our priority. We don't, neither of us operate out of status. We operate out of creativity more often than not. So events and appearances and scenes and parties, you know, that's easy, has always been easy to say no to.
Right.
And so it's just kind of taking, all right, why can we say no to that? And why are we worried about saying no to this independent film that shoots in Albuquerque and doesn't pay any money and it will be really draining? And so we've been able to recalibrate of it's because we like our life and we want to protect that life and we want to be present for our children more than anything.
Right.
And that is a very limited window of time too. We've got with our oldest, we have less than 10 years and then she's going to be out in the world and doing it. And So that's it. It's just, but there are people who crave work, that are defined by their work, and it's just different. It's just a different set of priorities.
But it's not like you guys are both working all the time. It really is about how and when.
Yes.
And I think that you have to, that it really is about making choices and feeling confident enough that the things will come to you that will go around what's most important, work itself around what's most important in your family. But it's hard.
Exactly right.
It's hard to do.
Yeah.
But once you do it, I think more and more, you get that confidence that those things will just kind of enter into your life if you make the space for them.
Yeah.
Which I'm saying after I like literally abandoned my husband for a year and a half and did Hamilton in New York. But, you know, for us, you know, before we have kids, we were like, okay, well, this is the time for us to do something like this. We've been together, you know, almost 10 years. So it was definitely like a stress test of our relationship and figuring it out. And now I know I will never do it again. If it's not, if it's too much for Hamilton, like the greatest play I could possibly be a part of.
Yes.
It's not worth it for anything. Just not that amount of time.
How far into it did you know that there was an end game of coming here?
I knew that it was, I remember it was at the Tonys that I started having that conversation with them. So that was what I started it in April of 2016. And by June of 2016, I was like, okay, so if I could stick it out through the end of the year and go to San Francisco, then I could come back to LA and we could just go right back into our life that we have here. And I remember very specifically at the end of New York having a panic attack. And I mean, I don't know if it really was a panic attack, but it was, I called up Gerald and I said, we can't do it. I love this very much, but I can't go to San Francisco for 5 months. This is just going to be too much. I don't think I can do it. You know, it's kind of like finishing up the time in New York and being like, oh my God, 5 months away from it is too much. It's it's insane. And we talked it out. And I honestly, if he didn't kind of be like, we can get through this, this is how we're going to do it. And this is why we're doing it. If he hadn't done it that day, I probably would have just panicked and not done it. And honestly, I hated doing it. You know, I loved doing San Francisco. I loved being there and I loved doing the show. But I just, it's too much.
Being away from your life,
Being away from your life. And you're like, well, what is work and what is opportunity all for if it's not, you're supposed to have it with your family, to share your life with.
I completely agree.
It was a good lesson for us at... So, a good lesson for me at a time that luckily it only affects two adults.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Totally.
It's everything changes when you have kids.
It does.
Imagine.
The priorities, like so immediate. Your priorities and your perspective, right?
Right.
So the priorities of keeping this thing alive, keeping this thing protected, being around so this thing knows that I'm the one to care for it and protect it and be there for it and love it unconditionally. But then the perspective, I remember almost immediately calling my parents and going like, you had a whole life before I existed and really understanding what that meant.
Right.
And the significance of that, the significance of that sacrifice, that if you were fortunate enough as I was to have two parents who do love you and who did sacrifice a lot to keep you supported and encouraged and loved.
Right.
That hit me. That hit me in a significant way. And my immediate response was like, oh, I can't wait to return that favor to somebody else.
Yeah. Well, that's amazing. Does it also increase your fear when it comes to making choices and work? Obviously, you know, we want to make those right choices. But like, especially, I joked that I'll be playing the king forever, but obviously I won't.
Yes.
I'm, you know, in the process of figuring that out, right? And when you're handed a job that literally you're like, well, you could do this for 20 years as an actor, that's insane.
I know.
It's not something that you have. And I guess I'm old enough and I've been through enough to hold on to it as tightly as possible.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So for you, you are, it's not the same, it's a different situation, but you have SNL, you're in this dream job that you've had for so long, you have to figure out the time to leave, right? And you have to figure that out professionally, but you also are thinking about your family and, you know, you have that in that fear of wanting to provide and make sure that you're doing stuff. How did you begin to figure that out?
Yeah, SNL was a really tricky departure because, you know, it's been talked about a little bit that it wasn't super smooth and in some ways surprising. But I've thought a lot about it. And the truth is like, I definitely made it known that that process and what it requires from you and the way that you are taken care of at that show was not conducive to my life anymore. By about 4.5, certainly by the end of 5 years, I was like, this just doesn't work for me. It's just not, I can't give the show, as much of me as it probably takes, and rightfully so, because there's so many people who that's the dream, you know, it is truly the dream. And I'm also not being looked out for in a way that I need for my life. And I certainly at a certain point felt that I had taken better care of the show than the show had taken care of me. And so there were conversations about that behind the scenes well before the hiatus of my sixth season. But I got to my sixth season and contractually you signed for 7, and I was like, I got one left. And you know, again, talking about priorities and family, was very presumptuous of like, all right, that'll be the last one. We'll sign our daughter up for school. We'll get locked in. We got one more year. Kobe was really adamant about trying to get involved in theater in New York and was doing that. And just like, all right, I got a year left. That summer, I had written and then directed and acted in this movie. And it literally took all of me. And that was like...
Killing Gunther,
yes. And that was a project with Kobe where I was like, I have to find out if I can do this. Right. And I will kind of be a ghost for these 2.5 months or so. And she agreed upon that. And that was okay. And it was still, that was, you know, it got a little tense at points because I'm asking a lot of her and it's a lot of work. And I'm also, you know, asking for a lot of support too. So it was a balanced thing. And we got through it fine because we were in Vancouver and that's where she's from. So there was good aspects of it too.
Sure. But you have those moments where you go crazy because you're obsessing about something. Like, I mean, I can have it about the podcast, which like, I literally can't listen to you talk about this stupid podcast. You know, like, can we not have our day be about this?
Yes.
So you have those moments with your partner you're like, you've gone away into this hole.
Yes.
I need you to come back to reality and life.
Correct. And she's taking care of real life things where she's like, I've been alone in this rental house with two human beings who have very different desires out of the day than I do.
Right.
And I need either you to check out and just be there to support me and hear about it, or you know what I mean, or let me vent.
Yeah.
And then I'm wanting the same from her, where I'm like, I just had a day where I had to like kind of be grumpy with somebody because they weren't doing their job and that balance, and I want you to appreciate how hard I'm working, you know. And it's just that, and both Kobe and I have been pretty good about communicating that. Even if it gets heated at a point, we can come down pretty quickly.
Yeah, it has to get heated. You can't. You got to go there, or you're just covering it all.
Just
up.
Holding it in. Yeah. But in the middle of this production, we get a call that's asking us to give an extension for the show to decide what they're going to do with the cast. Hmm. And I was just like, no,
yeah,
no, let me know. No, that's not fair.
Right.
That's, you should, I don't think you should need to know if you're really like, well, we don't know about Taryn.
After 6 years,
I've made it really clear that like, I'm happy to be gone too. So that was the response. And there were a couple other opportunities that had come up too that are, you know, boring show busy things, but my reps were like, let's clear these other things, tell them we'll give them an extension. And I said, okay. And so that's what they did, and that's what they went to. But I think SNL heard that like I was ready to be gone. And so 3 weeks later, whatever, you know, and it didn't even fall within what time limit they had asked for, they call back and they say, oh, we've decided not to renew the contract. And I was like, fine, that's fine, whatever. And with no like phone call from Lorne, no questions of like, hey, why or what's the decision? You know what I mean? It just was messy.
Yeah.
And it was also immediate validation that it was the right thing to happen.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's just like, okay.
I mean, talk about what we were just saying with you and Kobe. Like, when you have a relationship, you have to have that communication. And it might get heated, but otherwise it's just covering up. And clearly, that was like, we just... aren't going to be able to even engage.
Exactly. Exactly. And like certainly hurtful and certainly, frustrating, in mostly like probably out of ego of just, you want people to go like, we love you. And it really was felt very specifically Lauren going like, no, I'm done with you. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like going, okay, fine. Yeah. So it was fine because I had this project I was working on. I was busy, so I didn't really reflect upon it until we got back to New York.
Right.
And now I'm like, I'm in this city that doesn't feel like home. The city really is SNL to me because for 4 years, I didn't create any social life, have any experiences outside of work. I went right back to LA.
Right.
We've been here for 3 years.
You've been riding around in a limo for the entire time.
Just listening to Frank Sinatra on a loop. Holding on to that drug.
Yeah.
So, no, but it's like, you know, our life is PTA meetings and school and then SNL, and that's what the city represented. And I was like, what am I going to do here for a year? And I did have to do the post-production on Killing Gunther, which was great. But very quickly, like I think 2 or 3 weeks in, Tommy Kail called and was like, hey, Rory's going to go to San Francisco and we need to find a new king. Is that something you'd consider doing? And it was just like, thank God. Thank God.
Well, what's crazy is that we were on the same flight.
Yes.
When I got...
Yes, like when you were flying out to start.
Yes. You were one of the first people who knew that, that I had gotten this part, that they'd asked me to do it. So I was flying to New York from LA and you were with your family and I was like, Darren, you're not going to believe what I'm going to do. And you were like, oh my God, you guys were so great. You were the perfect people for me to run into. You know what I mean? Yeah, I could tell somebody and they would be like, oh, nice.
We're not going to...
Theater work, please. You know, they would have known. You guys knew and you were just as excited as I was.
Oh my God. So, and perfect. It was just like, oh, that's perfect.
Yes. And you came to the show like a month or two into my run.
Yeah.
And then I was like, I would really love to come to SNL.
Yeah.
And I came and I was at your last show on SNL.
I know.
Which we didn't know so at the crazy. Time.
Right.
And you know, I know that there was that story and I appreciate you like sharing it because I know it's not easy to share stories like that when you're saying goodbye to something that you love. But also like, I feel that a major part of that story is you were making that room with Killing Gunther, which I would love to talk a lot more about.
Sure, yeah.
Because you were finding what had to be next, you know, and maybe they were the ones who were like, okay, well, if you don't have room, if you need more in your life, then go.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe totally. That's clearly, that's exactly what needed to happen.
Totally.
I mean,
I mean, hindsight is 2020 and looking back, I don't know how I would have finished Killing Gunther doing that last year. I don't know what I like Kobe would have left me, like maybe probably not, because she really likes me, but
seems so, but yeah,
it would have been such an unfair ask because it's a 6-day week at SNL. It is even though like time off, you're constantly mentally consumed by it because you're responsible for creating your own content on a weekly basis. It consumes you. It is just fully consumes you, or at least me. It did the whole time. So I wouldn't have finished the movie. Then, you know, if you have to have a New York-based rebound job off of SNL that people are like, whoa, cool.
Yeah.
Hamilton is literally the only option.
Yeah.
It's the only option. And I was just so excited just being a fan of the show, being a fan of Lynn's, being a fan of Tommy's, being a fan of musical theater in general, being a fan of Broadway, being, you know, like it just was such an incredible gift. And I really will never be able to thank Tommy specifically because he's the one that, you know, really made it happen for just this just blessed gift of, I mean, you know, that cast, that ensemble, that crew are just, you're talking to union guys who have done 30 shows who are like, this one's special. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you know? And something that means so much to 1,300 people every performance. You feel it. It means so much. They've waited. They've paid. They have
saved
heard.
Their money. And they've slept outside.
Every night. And nobody involved in the show in my time there took that lightly at all and were so grateful. And it was such a positive environment where, you know, in sort of counterpoint to that, SNL is very cynical and it's very negative and it's very... sort of a lot of the work is disposable. You know what I mean? Even successful things air and then you throw it away and it's like, what's new, right?
Yeah. You're only as great as your last sketch 100%. That made it on the air. That
exactly. Yeah. So especially in the role of the king, and I don't think that this is a slight, is 10 minutes of stage time.
Oh my God.
The same song three times.
Absolutely.
Wardrobe does 80% of the job for you. And to get to ride on that bus for, you know what I mean? I did
I'm still riding it.
It is the best bus ride I've ever had in my life. Yeah. Truly. It was so positive and so emotionally charged in like only positive ways. I've said this many times, but I felt like a contest winner. I really did.
Yeah.
Every day.
Yeah.
And I did it the perfect amount too for me, where I was like so sad to leave and like, no, it can't be over. But also like, I'm ready to have my nights back too.
Yeah.
That I was spoiled. I just truly was so spoiled.
Yeah.
It was just the best.
Oh no. It's, you know, in comparison to Book of Mormon, which, you know, will always be such a wonderful experience for me. That's a show that I literally was like barely crossing the finish line after 2 years.
Yeah.
I'm 2 years in almost with this and I'm like, oh, I can do this forever.
Yeah.
Because it's just, obviously it's not as physically taxing. It's such a gift of a part.
That's
it's
awesome.
A gift on a silver platter.
Truly.
Tell me though, a little bit more about your creative experience in it, because yes, it's definitely so much is given to you, but I remember talking to you when you were in rehearsals and you were like, so how much can I play? I was like, oh, okay, well, I've been waiting to have this conversation with you.
Cool.
Because for somebody who has been trained to constantly create new material, to put something new in front of an audience, what did it feel like to have to do the exact same thing 8 times a week?
Yeah, it was such a different muscle, right? Such a different muscle in a role that I just never would take full ownership of, right?
Right.
Because as much as I would credit you for discovery and for moments and for stuff and for honing the role and the sound of it, and then credit Jonathan and then credit Brian.
Right.
It's also Lynn and Alex.
Absolutely.
And, you know what I mean? Andy and Tommy. It's by the time I got in there, you know, minimum a dozen geniuses had really kind of figured it out. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the expectation of the audience listening to an album and watching any sort of live performance, they're looking for something particular. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So even in 16 weeks, again, I feel like I'm fawning, but everybody there is so brilliant and so strong and incisive with what they do, but are also the best collaborators that I've ever worked with in my life, where, you know, the rehearsal process was so cash. It was too cash for me because my first Broadway and it's Hamilton. And I'm like, and they're like, you'll get it. It'll be fine.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I remember like coming backstage the first time to walk the show and Alicia's like, where the hell is my salad? You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
In the middle of Burn or something.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like, do you guys know what's happening upstairs?
Yeah.
So, but it is a job too, right? Mm-hmm. And you get comfortable with that. And I was more nervous than I can remember being the first 2 weeks, and like fully botched stuff in the best of ways, like knocking my head on the beams going out,
right,
and the crown fell off my head, my third
amazing
performance, and
oh my God,
so much of that
stuff.
That's
a great story.
Going up, like fully going up. The only time like I lost it, I would do is, because you know how repetitive some of the phrasing is. The only time I fully lost it and just went silent was at an Eduham show, which is great because you just hear 1,300 high school kids go,
Oh, damn!
No.
Yes.
Are you serious?
Yes.
That is so great. It was great.
And it was like before, like, you know, I just went, remember we made an arrangement. Oh, damn! And then I just went, I'm your man. And that got the biggest laugh that I've ever had just on that line. Because they were like, all right. All right.
Oh my God.
I was always so good at getting it back, at flipping it from like, oceans rise, empires fall. You know, it's much harder when it's all your call.
Yeah.
All alone or whatever it wasn't supposed to be. You know,
but you go to
I could get back to the next phrase for whatever reason and it wouldn't rhyme, but I was like, at least I'm back on track.
That, I mean, well, that's pulling out of your bag of tricks that a lot of us, like, you know, you can't, for me, I would not be able to kind of riff on Lynn's material. You know, like I'd just be like silent. What I do, this is my trick.
Yes.
Just keep moving your mouth.
Brilliant.
And they think the mic's out.
It's so smart.
You just keep talking, don't let sound come out, and they're like, oh, his mic's out, I can't hear him, and then you just come back in when you know what the words are.
That seems to require more thought than just like making it up.
Well, as long as you, as long as it looks
I'm
like
the king, you're saying something, the big old king.
Yes, yes. I went up on a song in off Broadway, and it was called Restless Leg Syndrome, the song. An amazing song. I literally had to improvise the entire thing.
Great.
And I think it was better than the original.
Okay.
But I actually go over every single word before I go on. I had one time around 500 or 600 shows in, which is exactly what I did. Yeah, exactly. I had this exact same moment with Mormon where I start to, it's not that I don't know what the words are to the song. It's that I don't know what words are. Like I start, it's like, are these, you know, like when you see a word and you're like, is that how it's spelled? And you're
right.
Like,
100%.
I can't be sure about this.
Yes.
It's like you're seeing it for the first time.
Yes.
It's like that with the entire show. So you have to, I think it's almost your body like kicking in and trying to force you to be present again.
Wow.
To be like, you're alive. Yes. This is happening. You think you're just in Groundhog Day, but you're not.
Be
alert. So I definitely have to go there. But one time I went on stage, I think it was like a month or maybe 2 months ago. And I said, John Adams, I know him. That can't be. That's that little guy who followed me all those years ago. And that's it. Instead of spoke to me, I said follow, right?
Yeah,
not
that
big a deal.
Right.
The entire cast was like, what? Oh my God. You know, because, you know, you hear one small thing and they're like dying.
Because
you're just begging for something wrong or something different to happen.
To come alive,
Yes.
Yes.
Please make this day different for us.
100%.
Dan Belnavis, who's in the ensemble, asked me if John Adams was following me on Instagram or Twitter. But yeah, no, it's such a, tell me just a little bit about what being on Broadway in general meant to you.
Yeah, it, you know, I started out doing plays and doing musicals and did musicals in middle school and high school and went to college for musical theater and remember seeing Cats. Remember seeing
every year at the Cats.
Every year, every
Big
night.
Bear
the Big
Auditorium.
Bear, Big Bear Cats. Big Bear presents Cats.
Yeah.
And I saw Les Mis when I was like 7, and that was then.
That was it for me too.
Oh, forget. Well, because you know, maybe it was the same. But Gavroche, you're like, is there somebody that looks like me right now?
Yeah.
That's a thing that we can do.
Yeah.
I can do that.
It's so true.
You do like building like a barricade out of my couch at home, and
so true.
And just the feeling that an overture and a strong voice does to me physically. It's a physical effect on me. So it always meant a lot. And I think going into college was starting to lean towards that path and that route.
Right.
And then comedy took over. Comedy kind of came, I was always funny and loud and obnoxious, but it kind of grabbed me and said, no, you're going to be in this field for a while. You're going to be seen as this kind of performer. So to have reached arguably the apex of comedy, or certainly sketch comedy, in America, and then have this backdoor entrance into this world that I revered and that I adored, was very significant. And has been, going back to turning work down and stuff, there were some really nice opportunities that came out of doing that that I've had to say no to. That's been heartbreaking. That's been like,
But it's a lot. Like, it's such a lot. You know what the commitment is now. And
we'll be 50 when both our girls are out of the house.
Yeah.
And both Kobe and I are like, because that was the other crazy thing, is like, I'm like, oh my God, it's Hamilton. It's the show. I'm in New York. Yeah. I'm doing Broadway. I'm a fraud, but they're letting me do it. How the heck? And then my wife, whose only creative goal, specific creative goal she's ever set for herself that I've seen in her life, was like, I want to be on Broadway. I want to do it. Gets a play a month and a half later with Kevin Kline. And she's phenomenal in it. And we get to overlap. You know, like, I would have done more. I would have done Hamilton for the rest of our time in New York, but she got the show, and then that's six nights out of the week with no mom or dad at home, and that wasn't doable for either of us. And she, Kobe, had sacrificed so much, and this was her goal, and she made it happen. I was so proud of her. But we got to overlap for 3 weeks, and that was magical.
Yeah.
Of Wednesdays and Saturdays, a built-in date between shows. We had, you know what I mean, these precious six of being parents of two children for, at that point, you know, 7.5, 8 years. And we're like, look where we freaking are. Look where we are. We're like truly living the dream. Truly. Like, that's the most living the dream I've ever felt in my life.
Yeah.
Of like my best friend, my wife, my, you know what I mean? Like my lover, and she's fulfilling her dream. I'm fulfilling my dream. And we're walking shoulder to shoulder through Times Square. It was unbelievable.
Right.
It was unbelievable. And once my real world, familial, primal, biological responsibilities have been met, I think both Kobe and I, that'll be sort of the first transition, first move.
That's like, great.
Yeah. Yeah.
But in the meantime, I wanted to talk about Killing Gunther before we go, because it's so impressive to me that the end result is so funny, so good.
Thanks,
and you
buddy.
Are, you did it, you know, like,
yeah,
I mean, like,
thanks,
you,
man.
You wrote it, you directed it, you starred in it. And it's one of those things where it's like, the only reason this exists on every level is because of you.
Yeah.
And that takes so much.
Yes.
And the years that must have gone into it. How did that start, and what were the high points and what were the low points? We talked a little bit about family, but just in terms of like getting that off the ground and making it happen.
Yeah, I mean, thank you, because that's exactly my feeling. Like, that's exactly how I sort of, you know, synopsize it.
Yeah.
I don't know, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, that's how I view it. Like, holy cow, I tried it, I did it, and I'm proud of it, you know? And it was very organic. I started writing it now, maybe 5.5, 6 years ago, something like a while.
Yeah.
And it was just, if I'm going to have opportunities to get a movie made and anybody care to see, what would that be? I want it to be very representative of me, not just tonally, but in structure, in genre, in look, in casting.
Yeah.
And I just set out to write Spinal Tap meets Heat, or meets The Professional, you know, because those are the two parts of me. The only way to incorporate a different part is if it were a musical, and I kind of got some of that in a very stupid way.
Yeah.
So I just started writing it that way, and would doubt it and go away from it. And it was a project that Kobe was very supportive of. And like, she's like a play it cool kind of girl. It's like, whatever you want, you know what I mean? Listen to yourself. But that was when she's like, that feels like a Taryn thing to me.
Yeah.
And I like that. And when I hear you talk about it, I see that you like it. So that was very encouraging. And, you know, presented it to Lauren's company, and they were like, oh, maybe. And then they decided to do a different thing. And then that, now it became my script, and was trying to partner directors to it and try to get it produced on my own, and met with my friend Ash, who got very excited about it. And he became a real champion of it, of like, no, we'll get this made. And I'm forever indebted to him. And It was very slow, very stumbly process, but we eventually met with this company, Starstream, who were like, yeah, we'll fund this. Because I wanted to do it super small. I wanted to do it very small.
Yeah.
Because at that point, I was like, well, nobody's lived with it as much as I have, and nobody has seen it. And if someone's willing to let me, I'm going to try to direct this because I think I could pull that off. I think I could do it. And yeah, this company just said, yeah. Then Arnold Schwarzenegger gets involved in a role that is always written as like a third act reveal, like a cameo, like, ta-da, here's our bad guy, you know, and it changed. It changed. And that was that was both a high point and kind of a low point, a logistical low point of, oh, we need to get a lot more money. And if we get a lot more money, we have to show that we got a lot more money. Mm-hmm. And we don't necessarily have more money to make it, but we need, you know, to put on screen. Yeah. All that weird logistical log, you know, budgetary, you know, line by line sort of dollars and cents, which I learned all about. And that was like invaluable.
Yeah.
Of just knowing what really goes into making a film.
Yeah.
But
you're learning it as you go. It's not truly, like you get to go take a course and then you apply it. You're like, okay. So how do you make each decision when you're without being completely crippled by the fear if you don't know what's right?
I was taking care of Steve Scalante was a producer on this, who Ash, another producer, kind of partnered me with. And he protected me. And, I mean, he saved me. He really did. Right. He just looked out for me. And
there you have to find those struggles. People to rely on.
Truly. And I mean, I owe him everything in terms, you know, as much as I got it made, he executed it, you know, always keeping me informed, always helping teach me, but also protecting me and keeping me at arm's length for certain decisions that I don't necessarily have to be involved in when I'm trying to prep a film and storyboard it and lock down locations and rewrite sequences. And so, you know, by the time we were in Vancouver, we were supposed to shoot it here, but again, budgetary, they're like, we'll save more money going to Vancouver. So I was like, okay, I would have been able to call in a lot more favors if we'd done it here, but you know, sacrifices to make it there. And it's Kobe's hometown. So that's nice too.
Yeah.
But by the time we were rolling, I'd worked so hard in prep, and the first AD, Dan Katzman, also was like, let's prep it, let's prep it, let's visit the sites, let's talk about it, let's know what we're going to do, let's no. And the hardest I've ever worked is in prep for that film.
Wow.
And it made shooting it really fun, really fun, and still fully consuming, fully draining, like not easy, but really fun. And really so appreciative to any person, everybody, you know what I mean?
And it was a lot of your friends. I mean, Bobby alone. But
yeah, exactly.
You had such a great ensemble of really, really funny people coming together and creating something. Was it hard to ask people for the favors or to, you know, like to be, this is the thing I'm doing. Would you be a part of it? Or was it like you believed in it so much that it was... like, let's go.
A little of column A and B, because I don't like that. And if I do the ask, then I certainly don't have the energy to go do it differently.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But I also had this train behind me that I had assembled.
Yeah.
Like, hey, so I put this train together.
Yeah.
Do you want to ride on it with me?
Yeah, yeah.
And that made it a little bit easier.
Of course.
But I do think... the next time around, which I definitely want to do again.
That's a good sign.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
just like that's amazing to be able to do it once and be like, oh, I'm definitely doing this again.
100%. And new while prepping and new certainly while shooting it. And then in post, you're like, oh, I have to do this again because I'm going to do all these things differently.
Yeah, yeah. But if you do it again, you learned...
I fully went to film school. And like you said, so much of this business is about what have you done? You know, I mean, so much. And SNL was a really big learning facility for that of like the show has become what famous person is going to be on it and who's going to cameo. And those are always the big moments because for better or for worse, our society right now adores celebrity and adores notoriety and fame.
Yeah.
Right. And to be fair to that, that all comes from having done work that means something to people.
Right.
Right. So they build this relationship with you. And I've built a relationship with people with this film, and people have been very kind, and other people didn't like it at all. But you know, the people who have given feedback and said, I appreciate this, like, what better reward is there
than yeah.
somebody had an experience because of you that enjoyed it and laughed and or yelled or frightened or scared, what, you know, that is very addictive to me, of like, oh, okay, I want to be, and because it means so much next time around, that's really going to inform the process. If ever I'm like, oh, why am I doing it? It's like, oh man, I want to make this as good as it possibly can be. And that requires scrutiny and harder work and also failing, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like this process was very informative in terms of how valuable failing is.
Hmm.
More valuable than, oh, you got it right, you know?
Yeah. You learned a lot more from whatever.
100%
brick wall.
Yeah, and that you're only going to learn or discover something new by tearing it apart or not doing it the way you think it has to be done.
Right.
So yeah, it was the by far the most fulfilling and engaging job I've ever had, professional experience I've had.
Right. Well, and like I said, I think it's no mistake that you saying yes to that mm-hmm. desire to make it was
yes.
the thing that really kind of instigated the room being opened up to you.
I think
that
you're right,
you
yeah.
know, that's where Hamilton came into play, mm-hmm. and you know,
mm-hmm.
and like I said, you know, it's hard for me. I'm trying to figure out when to step off the train
yeah.
of this great job, but you have to at some
yes,
point
right.
to give yourself room.
Yeah.
For good things professionally and personally. And I think that you and Kobe are just, you're great parents.
Thanks,
you have a great sense of who you guys are as people outside of the business.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's like why I want to talk to you. It's why it's the people I'm looking forward to talk with. So
yeah.
thank you so much for
thank you.
Sharing your
thank
story.
You, man. You're the best.
Living the dream. The first KG3, King George III, the fifth.
Mashup? I'm the
mashup,
fifth.
The
yeah.
fifth. The fourth.
KG3 mashup.
Fifth. That's right.
I know. That's amazing. I can't. I'm honored. And there's only in the whole world of like
all the kings. Well, you know, the British king just started their first previews today.
Yeah, I know. That's awesome.
Yeah. So it's international now.
That's so cool.
Well, they have a lot of kings in England, I guess. But
yeah.
people kept asking me that. Like, are you going to do it in London? I was like, I think they have
think
some
they
people there.
They have that
who
type.
Who can do it?
They've cornered the market on that
yeah,
type.
Yeah, I don't think they're looking for too many kings to put up.
They don't need to farm
house.
Out for
yeah.
a,
yeah.
a British Caucasian.
Yeah, I think they got it covered. No, but it's been so great getting to know you so
Thanks,
much
buddy.
More this last year, and
yeah.
getting to watch you go into the company of Hamilton was such a joy for me, because I was convinced no one would ever be more excited and joyous
yeah.
and entering that building, but
yeah.
you were. And,
yeah.
and you know, that makes it so much easier to like say goodbye to a good group of people when you have somebody coming in, tagging you out, who is just awesome. And they were so excited to have you and you killed it. I snuck in and got to see you perform and
yeah, thanks, dude.
You were phenomenal, and Broadway's going to get to have you back. Once you're finished raising those girls,
these friggin' tramps out of my house. You're the best, and I have so much respect, admiration, and love for you.
Thanks, bud.
Audition, side job, swimming upstream. Believe it or not, you're living the dream.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org. Because only together we rise.